Hey everyone, and welcome to Risky Business, your weekly information security news and current affairs show. My name is Patrick Gray, and on this week's show, we will be chatting with information security's enfant terrible, Nathaniel Wakelam. Apologies to any French listeners there for that truly awful pronunciation, but yeah, we'll be talking to Nathaniel Wakelam about some recon tricks he's been using in bug bounty programs. He uses some nice little tricks to rapidly identify ephemeral resources, and that often results in some pretty spectacular hacks, like, say, being able to download all of source code. That one was pretty cool because it was an ephemeral resource that got popped, and, you know, that's something you have to watch these days. Things come, they go very quickly, but that doesn't mean people aren't going to be able to find them and own them. It's a short and sharp interview, and that's coming up a little bit later on. This week's show is brought to you by Cylance. Cylance, spelled C-Y-L-A-N-C-E. They make machine learning-based AV software that, by all reports, works really well. Cylance CTO and co-founder Ryan Perme is this week's feature guest, and we're talking about something that we touched on briefly in the news last week. Gaming machine learning. Does Cylance worry that a determined attacker will be able to gradually input bad data into Cylance's learning set and game the whole system? Well, no, they're not worried about it, but it definitely is something they pay attention to. That's really interesting stuff, and it's coming up after this week's feature interview. But before we get into this week's news, I have an announcement of sorts. The first ever Risky Business Soapbox special will be running over the next few days. I'll be publishing that to the main feed in the next few days. It is a new wholly sponsored podcast that sort of showcases in-depth interviews with InfoSec industry executives. And the first one is all about security and DevOps and secure development. And yeah, I am being 100% sincere when I say I think this one has come up really nicely. It is sponsored content, but it's very interesting stuff. So do keep an eye out on the podcast feed for that one, particularly if development's something you know, within your area of responsibility, or if you're a CISO. There's certainly some valuable stuff in there. I hope to do approximately one of these Soapbox specials every month, so you don't need to worry about your feed being clogged up with sponsored content. And this, you know, the weekly show, isn't going anywhere. No changes at all. So yeah, do keep an eye out for the first ever Soapbox. But let's roll on now. It is time for a check of the week's security news with our good friend, Adam Boileau. And Adam, over the last week, all hell has broken loose in Russia, in the InfoSec scene over there.
Yeah, there's been a flurry of stories regarding some arrests made by the Russian government of two guys who worked at the FSB and another guy that worked at Kaspersky on what appears to be kind of charges of you know, treason or, you know, crimes against the interests of the state. You know, the Russian laws are rather broad in that regard, I gather. But no, there's been a flurry of reporting kind of tying that to a number of things, I guess. There's been assertions that it's related to these guys who were in the kind of IT crime section of the FSB passing information to the Americans or to foreign governments, specifically in relation to the attacks by the Russians on the, you know, various American political processes and you know, parties and things. That's that correlation at the moment, I think, is mostly timing based rather than anything more concrete. Krebs has a really good write-up of the relationships between a number of people in the kind of spam and malware and commercial criminal hacking scene in Russia and these guys. At least a couple of the people involved, one of the FSB guys, Dmitry Dukachev, was arrested for, you know, doing computer crime and then had his sentence, you know, magically come out a little bit shorter and now works for the FSB. So there's all sorts of infighting and, you know, jockeying for position going on. And it's not quite clear exactly, you know, what the makeup of all this is. But as you say, the thing that we can draw from this is that there is some interesting shit going down in Russia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we're talking about arrests for treason. Apparently, you know, could it be that they passed information to the CIA about the DNC campaign? Or is this part of some sort of internal Russian political thing? Because, of course, FSB and GRU had both hacked the DNC, but it was GRU who wanted to do the leaks. FSB didn't want that to happen. So, you know, there's some people I'm speaking to are saying this is like a lot of this has to do with just interagency politics in Russia, which, I mean, it's impossible to know.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, there's some aspects of kind of political stuff that's domestic to Russia. There's a hacker group called like Humpty Dumpty in English, which has been publishing sort of, you know, political related leaks internal to Russian politics. One of the people involved in this apparently was involved with that. And it's all kind of, I think you'd have to really be an expert on the Russian underground, to have a good handle on what's going on. Certainly Krebs's write-up talks about the relationships between the various people, and it actually ties into his book, the Spam Nation book that he wrote a couple of years back now, that, you know, it's the same sort of people. So yeah, it's really interesting and confusing to people from the outside.
Yeah, well, I've linked to a bunch of articles about all of those events, and people can go and read them if they're interested. That's in this week's show notes. But yeah, I guess we just have to rely on the Russian judiciary. those trials, I mean, you know, the treason laws over there are really vague, and the trials are going to apparently happen in secret. So, I mean, we just might never know actually what's happened here. But yeah, people can go and read and, you know, sort of see if they can glean a bit from what we've posted in this week's show notes. Apparently, Donald Trump was due to release an executive order on cybersecurity today, which involves like a 60-day period where the entire American internet is supposed to be, you know, have a vuln assessment done on it and stuff like that, the sort of stuff you'd expect out of the White House at the moment. But it's been delayed. No reason given as to why, but it was coming down the pipeline and then all of a sudden, but disappeared.
Yeah, I think maybe it's funny because a number of people read the draft of this executive order, which was somehow leaked, ironic in itself. And, you know, it wasn't, you know, whilst being, you know, rather sort of brief in terms of its time frame, you know, it was not on the scale of things Trump has signed executive orders about. Actually, was relatively sensible. It's like, let's figure out all things that are wrong, come up with some plans for doing stuff. Obviously, those plans for doing stuff are way more complicated than this particular executive order. But, you know,
it's an executive order for a pen test, basically, isn't it? Like,
well, yeah. And it's, you know, having a bunch of information with which to then make informed decisions seems sensible. I think maybe that's why he's delayed it, because obviously sensible executive orders,
we cannot have that.
We can't have that. That's just not how he rolls. So.
The 60 days thing does sort of jump out as being a little unrealistic, though, doesn't it?
Well, yes, it is. Obviously, it's way more complicated to go and understand the vulnerabilities across the entire range of critical infrastructure, let alone all of the other, you know, aspects that feed into critical infrastructure supply chains and, you know, the sort of the wider American internet. Yeah, obviously that's not a 60-day project, but I mean, it's a place to start, and there was no other real concrete action. I suppose one of the interesting things that was in that draft executive order was a focus on education and on whether or not the American education system was going to put out the right sort of skills that they were going to need, and then instructs the Secretary of Defense and the Secretary of Homeland Security to go and tell the education people how to, you know, run education, which, I mean, that's a little weird, but other than that, it's not the worst thing he's done. Done, I guess, now.
There you go. I mean, it looks borderline sensible. So color me surprised. And look, staying with President Trump, the Galaxy S3, I know it's weird. I have trouble saying that as well. But staying with President Donald Trump, the President of the United States, Donald Trump, he apparently is running his Twitter account from a Galaxy S3, which is, you know, not exactly the most modern Android handset available, and is in fact, you know, full of bugs. So that's interesting.
Yeah, you'd think that would result in a bad time. In fact, it's amazing that his Twitter account has lasted so well. I mean, you would have thought that by now it would have been owned at least a couple of times by someone for the lulz. But yeah, obviously using a Samsung phone when you're sitting in the Oval Office handling all of the sensitive stuff that presumably he now has to handle with his tiny hands, it seems like a thing that's just going to go horribly wrong. Although on the plus side, I guess when they go to have, you know, trade talks with South Korea, he can point to a Samsung phone and say that he supports Korean industry and all that kind of thing. So maybe there's some upside.
There you go. Apparently, Spanish police have arrested someone who's believed to be involved with the Phineas Fisher attacks, right? And this is really interesting because, you know, for a long time, you and I have been saying, well, it's obvious that Phineas Fisher is a group. Someone has got in contact with Vice Motherboard, and they're saying, hey, you know, I'm not in prison. It's not me, whoever they got. But, you know, when it's a group, like, that's pretty meaningless. I mean, is that your take on what's happening at the moment?
Yeah, I mean, I guess the story is still unfolding. I mean, clearly someone is still operating the Phineas Fisher mail account. And there's no talk of like crypto or how Motherboard has validated that it's the right person. But assuming that control of the email account is sufficient, yeah, someone's still there and still alive. But it's kind of... you know, we've talked about the idea that Phineas Fisher, at least one of, if not, you know, if it's a single person, that they are from Catalonia or from Spain, you know, somewhere in that region. And this was the arrests. Apparently they arrested three people, two in Barcelona, one in Salamanca, relating to the attack on the police union in Spain or in Catalonia last year sometime. So, yeah, it's not quite clear the police say that they have picked up some hackers, whether it's the right people. And there certainly is some scuttlebutt that it, you know, is Phineas Fisher or someone who's part of the group, according to Motherboard. But, yeah, we just don't know yet, and we will see. Of course, you know, Phineas Fisher has been pretty active in the media and talking to the media. You know, that sock puppet interview was, you know, comedy gold. So we will, I'm sure, hear from them in more detail. So
yeah, well, Phineas Fisher appears to have mastered a bunch of different sort of hacking disciplines and speak a number of languages extremely fluently, right? So I'm guessing it's not one person.
No, although, I mean, I guess that kind of multilinguality is not unusual in Europe. And there are hackers that are good across the board. But yeah, the signs do kind of point
to that degree, though. Like, the language is apparently spot on in every release, right? So, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I you know, I think you're probably right. It could still be one person, but yeah, I think probably a group is most likely.
Now, Leaked Source. This is the sort of Have I Been Pwned style site that was actually charging for access to data. It has disappeared, and there's been speculation there was a police raid on them.
Yeah, it's not quite clear exactly which police in which country, but yeah, one of the hacker forum posts is claiming that the site was raided, the drives were taken, and, you know, law enforcement are investigating whoever is behind it. Which I guess is not a surprise. I mean, operating a site like that in a high-profile state, you know, giving out creds to people for money wasn't probably ever going to end particularly well. Mm. You know, the question is whether taking this down, you know, makes any difference to the underground, which are, you know, quite used to paying money and trading for creds, whereas, you know, all of the researchers and you know, more above-board people who were using the site to kind of track what breaches had happened have now lost access to a, you know, important set of data.
Well, look, I mean, the key difference between them and Have I Been Pwned is that these guys were actually, you know, turning hashes into passwords and selling actual creds, right? So that was the sort of value proposition. And I'm thinking, given the scale at which they were operating, yeah, it probably will make a bit of a dent now that they're not around.
Yeah, well, yeah, maybe it will. But yeah, there seems to be no shortage of hashes and passwords out there when you go looking for them. Obviously, having 3 billion in one place for one easy price is pretty convenient.
Now, here's a story that's been doing the rounds, and I'm a little bit skeptical on it, only because the initial reporting was there's a hotel in Europe that apparently got owned. And the initial reporting says that guests were locked into their rooms, so they had to pay the Bitcoin ransom or whatever to, you know, get their systems back. But subsequent reporting has said that guests were locked out of their rooms, which kind of makes more sense. Or alternatively, that the hotel couldn't provision new room keys, which seems ultimately the most likely scenario in all of this. But either way, I mean, we're talking about operational impact against an organization because of ransomware.
Yeah, I mean, when this story first broke, I was also incredulous for the same reason. Because, I mean, I've never stayed in a hotel where you can't open the door from the inside of the room and go out, regardless of the state of the lock. And I'm sure if there were fire safety, you know, people would have something to say about that. The other way around, disabling the, you know, the key issuing system, you know, obviously much more sensible. The interesting thing in this case is that apparently the hotel did in fact pay the ransom. It was, what, 1,500 euro, which, you know, if you've got a hotel, you know, a luxury hotel full of angry guests, probably does seem pretty reasonable. But the hackers in question apparently had a back door, according to the reporting, and got back in and asked for another round of ransom, which doesn't really point to a sustainable business model for that particular crew. So sucks for them for having bad business acumen. But yeah, interesting kind of development in the ransomware, you know, approach to monetizing hacking.
Mm. Moving on to the Internet of Things, and apparently police surveillance cameras in DC got infected with ransomware, like, leading up to the inauguration of Donald Trump, which is just like, I mean, that is perfect timing, right? Did they pay or did they have to go and fix them?
Apparently they fixed them. There's no evidence that they paid, I don't think. Or the police are saying they didn't pay. Like, you know, I don't know that anyone's pointing to evidence in the blockchain that they did. But yeah, something like, what was it, 70 DVR, you know, camera systems got owned that were internet connected and held to ransom, which, yeah, there's something you can put on your review of the cybers.
Couple of news stories coming out of Facebook right now. We've got Facebook introducing support for UTF tokens, which is pretty cool. I mean, it's making buying a YubiKey to authenticate to various services look pretty sensible.
Yeah, and I think that's a really good place for things to head towards. I mean, the, you know, the YubiKey solution does seem to work pretty well. I mean, the challenge is making it work across all the client devices, you know, Apple's without USB ports and mobile phones and things. But yeah, I mean, even just using it for full desktops, really smart move. And it's good to see something as big as Facebook and with such a sort of a, I guess, diverse user base is the polite term I'm trying to come up with there. You know, having them roll out two-factor auth like this to that user base, I think is a really good thing to do, because then they'll start asking, why doesn't my bank do this?
Yeah, well, and, you know, in addition to that, we've got another story here where Facebook's teaming up with various organizations so you can do password resets via your Facebook accounts for third parties. Now, if you've got really strong auth for Facebook, I mean, that's, you know, that's going to put you in a pretty good spot, right? Like, just generally, Facebook being sort of an authentication broker doesn't seem like the craziest thing I've ever heard.
Well, no. I mean, in much the same way that, you know, Google is good at a whole bunch of things, we trust them to, you know, when we'll talk about their CA in a second, I guess. But yeah, having an organization that is actually competent, you know, root some of these trust systems instead of your bank or your telco or, you know, sort of the organizations we've traditionally outsourced identity to and that, you know, really don't necessarily have the credentials to do it right. I think this makes a lot of sense. And password reset questions, the kind of knowledge-based reset stuff is absolutely awful. And having a mechanism to replace that with something sensible, like we're talking about here with Facebook, providing password reset for third parties is just a straight-up good idea.
Two words should spring to mind when you are buying a VPN app for Android, caveat emptor. A study of nearly 300 like VPN apps for Android find that like most of them are pretty awful and some of them just don't even encrypt stuff.
Yeah, 18%, apparently, 18% just don't even bother encrypting your traffic. And then a whole bunch more will leak IP. 84% will leak IPv6, 66% leak DNS. A bunch of them, like, install rubbish CA certs to man in the middle of your SSL. A bunch install rubbish JavaScript in the pages that are being moved across the network. Like, they're all bad, it seems, pretty much.
Isn't there some sort of like native VPN support in Android? I would have thought there was. Why do you need a VPN app?
Well, it's not so much the lack of support in the OS. It's that you were buying a whole service, which typically comes with its own client implementation when they should probably just leverage the built-in one.
Well, that's what I'm getting at, right? Yes. Like, but why? But why? Article here on Ars Technica that I do have a little bit of an issue with. The headline is, it might be time to stop using antivirus. And in this story, you know, a bunch of really smart people are quoted, you know, people from Google like Justin Xu are quoted as saying, you know, they're sick of AV holding up their development of more secure software and, you know, more secure browsers and things like that, which I think is a totally reasonable point. But this idea that we should just abandon it altogether, that seems like pretty shitty advice for the average user.
I mean, yes and no. And you can certainly see that they have some very valid points. And you only have to look at Tavis's work against all of the AV vendors in the last few years to say, yes, like AV products in many cases are making things net worse for certain classes of users. For, you know, average home users, maybe that's not the truth. And I think that's
what I'm getting at.
Yeah. And yeah, I think in that case, maybe uninstalling your AV isn't necessarily the best advice to give. But certainly in a corporate environment where you have much more control over the state of the clients, I don't know that antivirus is a net positive. But for home user stuff, maybe. Although if you have a Chromebook, you know, you're in a much better place than you would be with a Windows box with AV on it. So, yeah.
Tough one. AV. Tough one. We could do a 2-hour show on it, I think.
Really. We could trash talk AV for absolutely 2 hours. That'd be no
well,
problem.
And you know, here's the next story. Drydex malware is back and it's got a new UAC Windows bypass method. You know, I mean, this is one of the reasons where I'm like, hey, AV, it's horrible, but it's kind of a bit of a seatbelt for most users, right? Like if your adversary is a nation state, then yeah, you probably don't want to run AV that cripples everything and starts, you know, running DLLs that, you know, don't have ASLR enabled and stuff like that, right? I get that. But for most people, it's going to at least act as a kind of seatbelt for them, right?
Yeah, maybe, I guess. Although you do wonder, like, you know, this particular, you know, Drydex is being distributed through macro malware in an Office documents and then dropping a UAC bypass. You know, how many AVs are going to pick that up on, you know, day 5 or day 10, right? I mean, it might not be that many still, so...
Yeah, but day 5 and day 10 isn't when everyone gets infected, Adam. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, I really understand the problem with AV. I get it, and they need to do better. And, you know, there are some vendors, I think, that are doing it better. But I'm just wary of telling people, broadcasting that, saying don't use it. Same reason I'm wary of people saying don't use password managers, because Tavis Ormandy can own them. Do you know what I mean? I don't think that's good advice either.
Well, I mean, that's not good advice full stop. It's not just that Tavis can own your password management. Using a password manager is a much better choice than managing your passwords in your head. So I think that's good advice. But yeah, AV, there's only a few cases where I think it would be a useful thing. But yes, anyway, that is, as you say, a whole another 2-hour argument.
That's right. Wired, and Andy Greenberg's written a couple of great stories up for Wired. He's written one about approaches to e-voting involving encryption that introduces a sort of level of transparency that would be quite beneficial. It's an interesting write-up on e-voting in, you know, the sort of modern contemporary environment, where you look at it and you go, wow, there's you know, e-voting is maturing into something where you think, wow, this could work quite well.
Yeah, I mean, sort of e-voting is one of those sort of perfect cases for academic cryptographers to really kind of flex their muscles and show how smart they are, because it's, you know, such a strange set of requirements in terms of verifiability and deniability and, you know, not having people cast multiple votes. So it's quite a very interesting problem from a computer science kind of point of view. And of course, it has resulted in some designs that do implement, you know, on paper, all of the things that we all want from a voting system. But yeah, the Andy Greenberg's article talks about, well, I think there's a county in Texas that's actually looking to pay to develop one of these systems and roll it out themselves, which would be great versus the kind of rubbish, you know, Diebold systems that we've seen previously for electronic voting.
Yeah, that, like, you know, press one and we'll record your vote into a access database, maybe, right? So that's, yeah.
If Bonzo Buddy lets us.
You know. Andy's other story this week is about a cryptocurrency called Monero, which is apparently the bad guy's choice of cryptocurrency, except for Bitcoin when they're stealing them, but apparently for, like, transactions within the sort of, you know, darknet world, Monero is really catching on.
Yeah, so I'm not really familiar with the internals of how it does what it does. But yeah, Monero is a distributed cryptocurrency much in the same way as Bitcoin, but with a whole bunch of, you know, core design choices to make it, you know, as anonymous as Bitcoin advocates think Bitcoin is, which is to say, you know, more than not at all. It introduces a whole bunch of things for, you know, batching transactions together and, you know, sort of encrypted block address, encrypted wallet addresses, so that you can't tell who's getting what money. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why that's a good thing. But yeah, clearly it has taken off with the underground, because the value of the currency is going up quite a lot compared to, you know, Bitcoin and other, you know, other cryptocurrencies. So yeah, one to keep an eye on, I guess. And if you're in the underground drugs buying market, one you might already be keeping an eye on.
There you go. Oh, this company in Florida, their telemarketing division left 400,000 audio files lying around. You know, the call might be recorded for quality purposes, right? 400,000 calls, and a lot of them contain things like credit card data and things like that. And that's, you know, there's no evidence that it's leaked out to, you know, criminals or whatever, but I think there was something like 28 gig worth of audio here. And yeah, someone got a hold of it and, you know, they managed to clean it up. But this is bad, right? You would really hope that companies really would protect this sort of stuff a bit better.
I mean, I guess the only mitigating factor here is that if you've got, what, 17,600 WAV files with people reading out their credit card numbers over the phone, you're going to have to listen to them or deploy some kind of, you know, speech recognition stuff to extract those numbers programmatically, which just sounds kind of complicated versus, you know, stealing the actual, you know, ASCII track dumps out of memory from a, you know, POS system at Walmart or whatever. So a little more work to actually monetize, but yeah, just so lousy, like leaving them lying around the internet for anyone to find.
Yeah, something to think about for those people out there who are recording calls for quality and training purposes. As you alluded to earlier when we were speaking about Google's other thing, Google is starting up its own Root CA, which is great news. I mean, is this just going to be for their own software, or will I be able to buy a Google Root, or will I be able to buy a, you know, Google signed certificate for my website?
I believe it's for Google to use for their own internal stuff and their software. I don't know that they were planning to offer offer certificate sign-on, although what they've actually done is they bought the global sign R2 and R4 root certs. So that, I guess there's a bunch of existing customers that are signed under that, that maybe they'll keep supporting. I'm not quite sure. But anyway, I mean, it makes sense, I think, for Google to have a CA, given how much work they've done, you know, on shoring up the CA infrastructure.
I'm guessing they just don't want to have to give any more money to Symantec.
Well, basically. Yeah, well, exactly right. Especially when they've been, you know, sort of smacking Symantec around the face so much recently for being rubbish with their CA. So yeah, I think it makes sense for Google to have one.
And finally, Adam, staying with Google, actually, Google has filed a legal complaint against this guy who registered google.com, but using the Latin G, like a capital G, as the leading G in google.com. So it looks a little off, but I'm sure it's enough to fool a lot of people. And he's put up some pretty crazy stuff at that domain, right?
Yeah, he has. He's got a bunch of, there was some phishing sites, and he's been doing some like click fraud apparently. Although we should point out that he has denied it. He said, and I quote, "Lie, I not spam Google Analytics users. What you mean fake traffic? Show me server logs and say what make traffic fake, lie, and bullshit." So strong
fake logs, fake logs.
Strong denials from Mr. Popov there regarding his misuse of Google.com. But yeah, Google is, of course, complaining and attempting to get the domain transferred to them, which frankly should happen.
Yeah.
despite Mr. Popov's assertions to the otherwise. Assertions to the contrary.
There you go. Adam Boileau, thank you very much for joining us for the week's news. We'll chat to you again next week.
Thanks, man. I'll talk to you then, Pat.
That was Adam Boileau there with a look at the week's news headlines. It is time for this week's feature interview now with Nathaniel Wakelam. Naffy is a professional bug bounty hunter based here in Australia, and he happens to be vacationing in my town right now. So we've hung out a bit and spoken about some of the tricks he's using to own stuff. And yeah, I think they're definitely interesting enough to talk about. And it is really interesting to me to talk to bug bounty hackers versus pen testers because, you know, an example, I recently spoke to a friend who did a 2 or 3 week red team exercise against a company that involved some really, really, you know, and I hate to use the word, but yeah, it was ninja tricks, man. He went very deep. And that was really interesting stuff. But then I go speak to a bug bounty guy like Naffy, and he just tells me about how he uses recon tricks to rapidly identify ephemeral resources that are intended to be spun up for like 30 minutes or weren't intended to hit the internet at all. Some bug bounty participants have just turned the whole bug bounty game into a recon prospect, you know. So, oh, look, here's a Git repo on an EC2 instance, and I know it belongs to company X because they're using an SSL certificate with developer at company name in the cert, right? So it's all stuff like that. A lot of it is OSINT, but it pays and it pays well. And honestly, you are as likely to get owned this way as you are by someone like my pen tester buddy with all of the ninja tricks. So I spoke to Nathaniel about all of that and also convinced him to tell us the story about how he freaked out Yahoo so much they permabanned him from their bug bounty program. Here he is.
Well, most of the stuff that I've been looking at more recently is looking at how every asset on the internet can be identified. Traditionally, you've got an IP range that will be done that a pen test will be done on, right? Because we're able to scan the entirety of the internet in near real time, we're able to actually identify all of the assets belonging to a specific organization and attack those. And because a lot of these bug bounties are pretty much open scope, we are able to attack those assets, which include things like staging servers and development servers on EC2.
Yeah, now that's really interesting, right? Because like people of my generation and you know, all the hackers I've known for 15 years or whatever, they're not really used to, and some of them have, you know, to be fair, like a lot of them have moved with the times, but it's a different kettle of fish, isn't it, in this sort of cloud-based world. And even identifying which asset belongs to which company, I mean, that's a new trick. I mean, it's not rocket science, but it is new methodology, isn't it?
Well, scraping public data sets that are available for metadata that we can use to identify these organizations has been invaluable. As much as I've got lots of good stories about when it's gone right, I've got as many as when it's gone wrong. One great example was an asset that we saw that me and a friend with a tool that we've designed saw come up. And 30 minutes later, when we went to test it, it had already gone back down again.
What was that, like some Docker thing that a developer had spun up or something?
It was an application to edit other people's user profiles. But because we weren't able to actually exploit the application, it's not eligible for a bug bounty.
And this is really interesting, right? Because you've got this totally new environment where you're going to have resources spinning up and disappearing very quickly. So you're almost sort of racing the clock a bit these days, aren't you?
Absolutely. Most of the bugs that I find that are what I would consider paydays are normally things that have been up for a day. We attack it. We find a vulnerability in it. We report that. And normally someone then gets contacted within a department and that asset will go down 30 minutes later because they actually have, due to the way that our AWS security groups work, a lot of these assets will be provisioned in the wrong place. So they're exposed to the external internet. And from there, we're able to just leverage the data we have to attack them.
One that I wouldn't mind talking about a little bit, and I know we probably can't mention the company name, is the one you do a lot of this stuff with a guy, another Australian guy named Shabam Shah, who was also in town the other day. And he scored a beauty, which was identifying a source repo for a very, very well-known company, like a Silicon Valley company. But I mean, this source repo had their, like, all of their source in it. And he just did that with some passive recon tricks. Can you walk us through that one?
Yeah. So one of the tools that we've been actively developing allows us to do passive and active reconnaissance and also attacking. And using this this tool, Shabam got an alert on his phone, which said that a Git repository had been found on a QA box for a major Silicon Valley company. He then pulled that down and realized that all of their production keys were in it for everything they used. So he had full access to compromise a company that everyone knows and loves. Straight off the bat.
It's lucky for them that it was him who found it. And I guess that's, you know, that's why people use the bug bounties and stuff. It's good having people looking. But what are some of the most effective recon tricks? Because I know that one of the things that you do is you love using SSL certs and like metadata and SSL certs to find stuff.
One good trick that we've used with quite a bit of success recently has been actually looking up email addresses in SSL certs. So if you've got, say, at company.com somewhere in an SSL cert, to me, that's then in scope because it may not necessarily be an asset that belongs to the company itself, but it's definitely an asset that belongs to a developer within the company. So if we were able to attack and breach that asset, you know it has some kind of trust relationship with that organization. And normally, if you're able to attack these development and staging servers, a lot of the time we find that the information that you gather from them can allow you to actually launch fully fledged attacks against the assets that do belong to that organization.
Yeah. And I mean, the solution, I mean, that's just a recon trick, right? So it's not exactly something someone can fix because all that's doing is pointing you in the direction of a vulnerable asset.
Well, no, you are able to fix that because if you're deploying staging and development boxes, there's absolutely no reason that me or anyone else needs to know that it is associated with your company. It's not going on the external internet with the intention of ever being used. It's going on the external internet so someone can do some quick testing.
So maybe use your Gmail address for those.
Maybe don't even have an SSL certificate. It's a staging box.
Yeah. No, that's a fair point. Now, you're also having a bit of fun with CDNs. And this stuff is pretty interesting.
We've done a lot of research around unique identifiers in HTTP responses because what we've been able to identify and notice is that if we scrape the internet for everything open on port 80 and port 443, we can then actually say there's a unique CDN, like cdn.companyname.com, that is in every single response. So we can then say all of these assets that have that in its response belongs to that organization, whether it's an IP address or whether it's an actual proper host associated. So we're then able to attack all of those assets because they're in scope for us.
Now, speaking of CDNs and the like, you've also developed techniques that let you find where the real assets are behind services like Cloudflare. And, you know, I get that you don't want to give up all of the techniques that you have to do this. But, yeah, you can actually just pop around behind these services and attack the actual boxes. And that's been pretty good. You've had some pretty good gets that way.
It also means that we can perform proper brute forces because normally one issue that you'll come into with Cloudflare is that you get blocked. If we find the actual origin IP address, we can then attack that directly. We don't have to deal with those issues.
One mitigation to that you'd think would be to just IP restrict your web server to Cloudflare.
Yeah. yeah.
So, I mean, that's something simple that people can just do. I mean, basically what you're saying is that you're not getting full value out of those services unless you do that.
If you're not doing that and you're using an upstream provider as a, if you're relying on an upstream provider to do security for you and you're making mistakes like that, you're no secure than when you started to begin with. It might stop the run-of-the-mill attacker, but it's not going to stop anyone that, you know, can look up something like scans.io or the census records, which you can register on census for free and you can look up all of this information.
And I guess, too, like there's no point IP restricting it after your range has been identified, because that's not really going to help you in a DDoS scenario, right?
It won't at all. And there's lots of organizations that that I can think of off the top of my head where even though they have now put all their assets behind Cloudflare, we still know what the origin IP addresses are. So if you want to attack them, there you go.
Yeah, I mean, for DDoS, right? You won't be able to do any sort of SQL stuff, but you can, yeah. And there's, you know, you guys have got some other like really nifty tricks. There's one involving favicons.
Yeah, so you scan the internet for all the favicons that are there on all the common HTTP ports, and then you just MD5 them and see what matches.
I love this stuff. Of course, you know, the bulk of your work, I mean, this asset discovery stuff is really cool and really interesting, but I'd imagine the bulk of your work is still just going to be automatic testing for things like SQL injection, cross-site scripting. Is that right? Or does the recon side and then the web app side sort of go hand in hand? You use the asset discovery to find the thing and then you start shredding it, especially when you're not having to go through their CDN anymore.
Well, you can't hack what you can't see. And if you're able to actually identify these assets on the internet, you pretty much win. Most of the time, the more and more that you extend your attack surface, the more likely you are to be able to breach or gain some foothold into an organization, at least in my experience.
Now, one thing here, right, that you told me about, and it's kind of funny because I don't think customers are going to be thrilled to hear this, but they need to hear this, right? People commissioning bug bounties need to hear this, which is you double dip all the time, right? Like you'll find a bug in some company's US environment, you'll submit a patch or, you know, submit a recommendation, they patch it, but then they don't patch other regions. And then you just hit up those other programs, right? Why do you think it is that people are so slow to propagate stuff globally?
Well, historically, I would suggest that it's business logic that is the problem here, because these organizations do have an understanding of security. They have an understanding of what constitutes a valid bug. But if they don't understand the intricacies of their environments, they're no more secure.
You're happy to point it out to them at $5,000 a pop, basically.
Yeah, absolutely.
Now, look, this is all really interesting stuff, but I'm going to ask you to tell a bit of a story here. Your most recent permaban from Yahoo's bug bounty program. This is a lovely story. Could you tell it to us, please?
So I was testing Flickr, and I made my username a blind XSS payload and then asked someone at customer support if they could look up my account as my pro subscription hadn't gone through. They looked up my account and it fired. Then it fired three or four more times on different employees. And where the blind XSS actually fired was a global Yahoo administrative panel. And I then got permanently banned for exfiltrating data because it took a screenshot and sent it to my email.
What I love, I mean, can you just tell us also what the name of that control panel was?
God.
Yeah, so you got the God panel. Was that Yahoo Global or was that just Flickr?
It was both.
Yeah, okay. So what I'm guessing, my feeling is, yeah, screenshot, not really, I don't know if that really qualifies as exfil, but I'm guessing you just made him very, very nervous. Is that what you think happened?
Absolutely. I think there's also, I'll admit that at times I can be a little bit too passionate with what I do. And I would suggest that with a lot of the things that I've done in the past, I've probably strained the bonds of friendship. Though I think that you've got, when it comes down to it, you've got to look at the motivations behind the behavior, right? Like someone may take a step out of line, but if they're doing it with the best of intentions, you kind of...
Is this your way of actually apologizing to Yahoo?
Absolutely.
Well, there you go. Never thought I'd see the day. So it seems like the main takeaway from this interview is that assets are spinning up, whether that's on organizations' own servers or, you know, VMs on their own bare metal, or whether or not that's in the cloud. There seems to be a bit of an assumption out there that it's invisible. Developer teams are assuming that these things are invisible. And I guess what you're saying is they're not.
Well, this comes back to security through obscurity, right? If you're relying on hiding a needle in the haystack, history will tell us that that doesn't work. And as far as IT security is concerned, we know that doesn't work. You've got to be securing these things and you've got to be thinking it through. If you're not doing that, you are going to end up getting breached with things like staging servers and development servers that are exposed.
Nathaniel Wakelam, thank you very much for joining us on the show.
Cheers.
That was Nathaniel Wakelam there. And yeah, I hope the Yahoo people heard that as well. Nice little sincere apology there from Nathaniel. Okay, it is time for this week's sponsor interview now with Ryan Perme. Ryan is the co-founder and CTO of Silence. Silence, of course, makes antivirus software that is based on machine learning. And I'm yet to meet a customer of theirs who doesn't just love it. It's easy to deploy, easy to manage, relatively light and very effective. So if you want something that's easy to manage and you'd like to spend vastly less time reimaging boxes when they get hosed by viruses, do look into Cylance. Now, machine learning is the new coolness these days, but we're starting to see a new field of offensive research emerge, involving tricking machine learning systems by either poisoning the learning set, the learning data set, or enumerating the ML brain and then finding gaps that you can exploit. It is going to be a fascinating area of study in coming years because machine learning is used in everything from intelligence analysis to drone targeting to antivirus to all sorts of things, self-driving cars, for example. So I thought I'd ask Ryan what he thinks of current approaches to gaming ML by poisoning the data sets. Now, as you'll hear, he basically says it's something to keep an eye on, but it's not something that keeps him up at night. As I mentioned, there are really two approaches to messing with machine learning. You can poison the data that the machine learns from, or you can use enumeration to essentially figure out how the machine makes its determinations and classifications, and then try to identify which characteristics you'll need to introduce to your malware so that it'll go past the defenses. And we'll tackle that one another day. Today, we're looking at how Cylance can actually protect itself against poisoning the well, mostly because we spoke about a paper on training set poisoning in last week's news segment. And well, it turns out that trying to poison the data set isn't really a good approach for an attacker in the case of malware and, you know, Cylance specifically. It would require a long campaign at scale to even begin to move the needle when it comes to how they classify stuff. And if you're going to go to all of that trouble to try to bypass their software by poisoning their learning set, well, they've basically already won, haven't they? Because at that point, you've transformed ownage from being a commodity into a luxury. Anyway, I got Ryan on the line and asked him for his thoughts on machine learning training data poisoning. And here's what he had to say.
So it's an interesting space. Right now, the paper that you referenced was pretty much about poisoning the training set. And there are a lot of approaches that do sort of rely on a continuous amount of input. They're called online learning algorithms. They shift over a period of time, or alternately even offline ones that require sort of me to take your data to train on. Let's say I'm going to go and solve a problem for you. And I take your input as sort of how I build my my classifiers. The reality is that this is sort of garbage in, garbage out, writ large. If you allow an adversary into your training cycle, you're going to probably have problems. Now, there are a lot of defenses against this. First, not letting them control the entire set. Second, having an immense amount of data so that they're just a part, a voice in the choir, as it were. And then third is probably most important, making sure that you actually test your model efficacy in the real world so that you actually understand its strengths and weaknesses. These are like the big ways to kind of combat training type of attacks. There are a bunch of others, though. The reality is that ML is defined by your ability to describe the problem and the approaches that you take to solve that. Many, if not most, ML problems are about sort of making a classification. Do you fall on one side of the fence or on the other? And the reality is how you define that fence is effectively how you're going to solve the problem. Right now, we're tackling malware, and our models internally use between 5 and 7 million data points. File has all 5 to 7 million, but the existence and non-existence in a non-linear way starts to define this. So what this is called is high dimensionality. Now, the nice part about that is that high dimensionality allows you to more precisely define what a problem is. And it makes it a lot more resilient to people trying to screw around with you.
Okay. So like, I'm imagining though, like just let's walk through a really simple scenario about how you might game something like a machine learning tool designed to classify malware. I'd imagine you'd start seeding builds of, you know, legitimate binaries that don't do anything suspicious, but you might introduce something slightly shady into that, right? That gets that to consistently fall on the good side of the fence. And then, you know, you sort of train, you make sure that your customers are going to see that, that your software running at your customers is going to see that and classify it as good. And aren't you gradually then training the system to accept that characteristic as good?
So in an online environment, absolutely. There are really kind of two problems that that ML can solve. One of them I would call sort of a local problem, which is I take the data from your network, your host, your world, and I create a model specifically for you. The other is a global problem in which I collect information from all around the world and I solve the problem once, and that problem, that solution is generally useful for everybody. Now, in a local problem, absolutely. If you're taking relatively untrusted inputs as a function to training a local model, you end up with less data. In other words, the number of files on your network, depending on the number of hosts out there, but the number of unique files are going to be somewhere in the just gut check of about 1.5 million. When we train our models on a global level, we're training on about 300 million good files and 300 million bad files sourced from literally all over the world, many sourced with a very high degree of trust. In other words, we get files directly from Microsoft. And so the amount of input that an individual can have gets dwarfed sort of, again, by that one voice in a choir. Nobody can directly and meaningfully impact an overarching training solution if it's not in their control.
So it's a question of scale, right? And I get that, but I mean, could you automate the f***ery, right? Like that's the question, and I imagine that's where, you know, where most of your work would go in trying to combat this, because really, like, you could automate that build process, you could automate the seeding of it. There are botnets out there that could distribute something that will get flagged as good with one shady characteristic. I mean, you know, would it be? I'd imagine though that if someone really scales it up that much, it's not going to go unnoticed, though, is it? And I guess that's an inherent sort of defense.
So years ago, there was evidence of this happening in VirusTotal. What happened was that certain people were trusting VT quite a bit, and what was beginning to pop up were otherwise clean binaries that were being marked as hostile. And what that did is it started to sort of poison the trust network, so that people were less willing to believe what other participants were saying because they weren't certain how trustable the output would be. This was eventually countered by adding better controls over where things were sourced from. And that's part of what we're going to sort of see here, is that there's always going to be trust issues. Just blindly believing what somebody tells you is going to get you the kind of result that you would expect, particularly as we're dealing with security issues. We take a first order approach. We don't train on hearsay. Everything that we see has been internally built and vetted. And so the reason that the VirusTotal thing ended up getting sort of noticed was that the people who were perpetrating it, and nobody is certain who in fact was doing this, overdid it. They did it so much that it wasn't at that point a question anymore. It was more those types of files just now get excluded at first by the participants and then later by VirusTotal, up to and including putting guards in place to sort of prevent this type of behavior going forward.
But I'd imagine too that if you did have a problem with an adversary managing to get enough input into your system to shift the needle, yeah, you're probably going to notice that. And it's an easy thing to tighten up, I'd imagine too, because then you would just tighten your criteria a little bit, just give a little bit of a human intervention, adjust some thresholds, and bang, all of that effort that they've put into gaming the system sort of goes away, right? But the key is you've got to notice it happening.
So ultimately, this comes down to the reality in machine learning and where humans are absolutely invaluable. As you kind of led with, machines are kind of dumb. They do what they're told to do. And if you don't have a human defining what the problem you want to solve and measuring how effective you are at solving that problem, you're probably going to get a bad result. Mm. The machines are phenomenally good at finding patterns, phenomenally bad at assigning meaning to those patterns. And realistically speaking, most of the problems that we're trying to solve are all about meaning. I have this binary. Does it, do these things mean it's good or do these things mean it's bad? And realistically speaking, we use humans to define that output. Now we have a kind of a saying here. We really have two elements that we approach ML with. Element number one, let humans do what humans are good at, let machines do what machines are good at. What that really means is that humans are really bad at understanding patterns. That we see them everywhere, and we tend to think on small amounts of data. Machines are phenomenal at looking at big chunks of data and finding inconsistencies within that data. And what you're describing here in terms of an attack would be sort of that inconsistency. It doesn't fit the mold of the vast majority of data that you have. And so it's anomalous. Now, does that anomaly mean it's bad or does that anomaly mean it's good? And that's where humans come in.
Yeah. Humans at least, you know, it's brought to your attention so that you can actually make that call, right? Like, and that's the thing if you're dealing with enough data. Although one thing I'm curious about, right, you know, you guys often cite that you make your determinations based on 7 million different characteristics and whatever. Which is kind of funny to me because I'm guessing that it's the top 15, 20, right, that are 99% of where the value is on this, right? So I'm thinking if you're going to try to game a machine learning thing, okay, sure, but you can't forge, you know, just because you're gaming the machine learning, you can't forge, a valid signature on a binary, which I'm guessing is like, you know, 99%. If you don't have a valid signature on a binary, you're getting flagged as suspicious by something like silence, right?
Absolutely. There are some pretty basic level elements. So one that comes to mind, if you're above 3 megs, you're probably safe. And by probably, it's something like 69%. Now the reality is on its own, I can't say that you're safe because you're over three megabytes in size. The flip side is that when we have between 5 and 7 million features, we're not feature hoarders. That's ultimately the cutoff point. And we start with many, many more features than that. That's a cutoff point of those that provide meaningful value. Now, the other thing that you got to remember is that it's not just individual features. In other words, file size, it's features in combination. So ultimately, when you take a nonlinear approach, it could be something like, a file is greater than 3 megs and it's missing this and it has this other thing, that means it's good. And the way that you end up kind of lining this up, it's not individual pieces. Now, that doesn't mean that you can't screw around with individual. The reality is that there are some more definitive features than others that more strongly influence the outcome. That being said, they're not typically the obvious ones. They're not the ones that necessarily you or I could sit down and say, oh, that makes a lot of sense. This is part of the let humans do what humans do well, let machines do what machines do well. The machines are defining those features based on the importance at scale. And oftentimes they're not very simplistic. This is why in a lot of machine learning approaches, you can say at a very high confidence that it's A or B, but it's pretty difficult for you to literally say why you came up to A or B, because the interactions of that number of features builds a really complex network, and it's not one, two, or three things that you can say definitively it's bad because of A or B or C. Now, the other part kind of going to what you were talking about. We have the let machines do what machines do well part. The other part is if you can't show the math, it doesn't exist. And that's all about measuring and keeping yourself in connection to reality. And that's sort of the second defense there, is that if you're not always measuring, if you're not always connecting yourself to reality as it's happening, you can get divergent very, very quickly. And those divergences are the wedges that the attackers could potentially use there. Gaps between what you see and what you don't, it goes back to the heart of security. What you don't know can absolutely hurt you. And so measure broadly and continue to refine those measurements so that you're seeing if your model diverges from reality.
In other words, I'm guessing what this all comes down to is keep an eye on that thing.
Yes.
All right, Ryan Perme, thank you very much for joining us on Risky Business to have a bit of a chat about machine learning and malware and all that good stuff. It's been a pleasure to chat to you. We'll talk to you again soon.
Thank you.
That was Cylance CTO Ryan Perme there with a chat about machine learning. Do check them out at Cylance.com. That's Cylance.com. And that is almost it for this week's show. But before we go, of course, it is time to hear from our good friend, Jake Davis. And you know, with everything that's been going on in the world, I've become a little stressed. And I'm sure many of you out there are feeling it as well. Russia has, you know, escalated its conflict in Ukraine. Syria's still a mess. There are huge protests in the streets and in airports in the United States. Lots of political argy-bargy. So this week, Jake Davis is here to help you all wind that back a little bit. Instead of Story Corner this week, we're doing something a little bit different. It's Guided Hacker Meditation with Jake Davis. I hope it helps you zen out. You'll be hearing from me in a few days in our first ever Soapbox special. But until then, I've been Patrick Gray. Thanks for listening.
Hello. And welcome to Guided Hacker Meditation. Today, we install Python 2.7 locally through the Bash shell, the most zen and calming shell of them all. First, we breathe. We inhale and we type mkdir, for we are making a local directory. Exhale and don't forget the -p flag /local. Now we wget from python.org/ft/python/2.7.3/python-2.7.3.tgz. Now before we tar, we relax again. Inhale, tar, XVZF, Python-2.7.3.tgz. As you can see, it does not matter if we call a dot a point a dot. All that matters is that we do not install Python 3. Now, cd python-2.7.3/configure make alt install prefix =local, for we must specify the local installation directory. Now, ln-s/local/bin/python2.7/local/bin/python. And relax. Close your eyes and cd... Soon, you will be ready to move on to installing the setup tools and pip for package management. Until next time, hack the planet.